Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Brave young lovers and follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and clinging very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you.
Hadley Gustin with us, anxiety coach, motivational healer, self-help writer to college girls struggling with anxiety, having silently suffered from a severe and chronic anxiety disorder for over a decade. She experienced countless panic attacks, symptoms such as uncontrollable neck and hand shaking, spontaneous sweats, full body tension, shivering, stomach queasiness, and the list goes on. And over the course of her teens, her disorder became so out of control that it finally consumed every minute of her day, and it was literally nonstop. Finally, at 19 years old, while she was away at college, she hit a Powerball wall and realized the two key facts here. One, she could no longer stand living each day with those numerous symptoms, and in fact, having that anxieties is, I can say anxiety disorder five times. She's laughing at me over here. Hadley, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Michael. That's great to be here.
I don't know if I can say anxiety disorder four times. Okay, Hadley, let's go back to when you were a kid, when it first started. You know, the symptoms, obviously, your mom, your dad, somebody had to notice that this was not normal. How did it go for so long without it being checked?
You know, and it's interesting you say that. I was told as a young kid, and then, you know, to this day I'm still told this, I was born a very worried child. And I certainly suffered from my share of fears that obviously escalated and grew into a full-blown anxiety disorder. But, you know, up until I was 19 years old and I came forward with it, my friends, my family, the people closest to me told me basically, you know, We never saw this coming. You masked it so well that we had no idea you were suffering like this. So it was pretty crazy. I figured everybody could see my symptoms and what I was going through, but in actuality, not at all.
But why is it that you hid them? What was it that caused you not to let the world see? Were you embarrassed? Did you think you stood out from the crowd? What was it that caused you to not let someone know?
Most people struggling with anxiety can relate to this, but I was very embarrassed. I was very ashamed. I couldn't even say it out loud to myself until a few years ago. And a big part of that was, you know, I thought I was mentally ill, that I was going insane, that I would be committed if I ever came forward with the fact that I was suffering from anxiety. So I was so terrified of that that I said to myself, you know, I'd rather deny that I even have it, and I would just rather suffer in silence here than actually come forward with this.
So realistically, we're talking about survival, and I wonder how many kids and adults go through the same thing, that, you know, if they let somebody know, there's going to be a problem, and if it gets out into the open, that I may not be able to deal with this, and so many other things that come out of it. You know, luckily you went to school, you did something about it, but what about those people who go through that and never take those steps that you took, never go out to that maybe ongoing and continuous education, that life that they could have had that they didn't do? So it's very interesting that you stepped out so other people could realize that if they were going through it, not fun, not necessarily okay, but there's a fix here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, that's ultimately what led me to, you know, starting my business and my career as it is today, is just knowing that, you know, if I could do this, if I could come out okay on the other side, then I need to spread that message and help as many young women like myself do the exact same thing.
But does this happen also to men?
It does. You know, and it's interesting, after looking at many statistics and information from medical professionals, anxiety definitely tends to manifest more in women. Why, I'm not so sure of, but I guess it does. But definitely there's a huge number of men out there going through the same thing. And if not anxiety, you know, other mental health disorders as well, depression, ADD, OCD, you know, the list goes on. So I think most people out there, you know, we're all suffering from something that's mental health related.
Okay, now let's talk conventional medicine, allopathic medicine, chemicals, and so on and so forth. Did you start out with the conventional doctors, those doctors that would take you through whatever it was going to be, the tests, et cetera, and could they do anything about it? Could they find anything?
You know what I did? When I was about 13 years old, I saw a therapist for the first time and did talk therapy. And it lasted a couple of months. It really didn't work for me, and I thought at the time that it was a complete failure. Years later, when I was in college, I saw a therapist for the second time who led me to see a psychiatrist. And that's essentially what I wanted. At that point, I thought that, you know, the only thing that was going to knock this out of me was pharmaceutical drugs. So I definitely tried Western medicine. And for the most part, I mean, you know, when I was on the medication and stuff like that, I felt a lot of my symptoms subside, and I was able to live a pretty normal life for the first time. But, you know, having said that, I still felt that I wasn't dealing with the root cause of the problem. And Western medicine being very diagnostic and, you know, here's what your issue is, let's prescribe you something now, I wasn't happy with that approach anymore. And so knowing full well that my symptoms could come back, it really didn't matter, but I was determined not to be on drugs any longer and to find another way.
Now, how did you come across the holistic end of it? Because when it really comes down to it, we keep hearing holistic, and it's gotten to a point where there is a tremendous amount of validity behind it. And by the way, I'm totally on board with it, so don't hear that I'm not. But then you have to make that step, because if you do that, all of a sudden it's airy-fairy and it's, you know, the wild stuff, and it's not for real, but it is very much for real. So how did you find it? How did you transition to it?
You know, it's interesting. I actually grew up in a household and was raised living a very natural, organic lifestyle. Both my parents were behind that kind of thinking. But I really didn't take hold of it until this past year or 2 years ago. And, you know, it was interesting. I saw a film. It was called Crazy Sexy Cancer by a woman named Chris Carr. And as the title says, you know, it's about cancer. It's about this woman with cancer who holistically heals stage 4 cancer. And after watching that, you know, it came at the perfect time because I was detoxing off of these very powerful medications and really had no plan other than that. But seeing this film, you know, I said to myself, if this woman can heal cancer, this deadly disease, with holistic methods, I can absolutely do this for anxiety. And the results that I experienced were just astounding. I mean, it was healing like, you know, the drugs couldn't even give me. So I think it's very real, and it's our best option to get where we want to go in life is holistic health and healing methods.
Okay, Hadley, let me bring this to a practical level. Let's say I've got anxiety, I've got the shakes, I've got the whatever. I come to you. What are not everything, but what are some of the steps that you would take me through to begin the process of bringing me back to health?
Great question. Part of coaching, which I love as opposed to the Western medicine model, is it's individualized. It's not a one size fit all. So depending on, you know, what your symptoms are, you know, if it's shaking, if it's queasiness, if it's full body tension, depending on that and depending on also, you know, after hearing the different healing modalities that I work with, you know, what resonates with you from the start, it's really based on that. So, you know, if you showed a natural disposition or liking to meditation, or to yoga. I personally think, you know, with there being over 400 different kinds of yoga, that everybody can find a variety or a genre of yoga that they like. You know, things like that. I also work very much so with aromatherapy and essential oils. I am a huge believer in dietary shifts and changes, you know, adopting more of a plant-based, whole foods, raw diet. That works wonders on most people, I found. So anything of that nature, you know, obviously I'm leaving out other healing modalities, but those are definitely some major steps to take to start to see dramatic changes in your anxiety.
Okay, well, but let's go back to, and we can understand what yoga would do, what meditation would do, But what about the aromatherapy? What are we dealing with there with those essential oils? How does that in and of itself bring you to some kind of a grounding of calm?
Great question. You know, everybody responds differently to the oils. And really the ones that you're most attracted to are, it's symbolizing the imbalances in your body. And this changes constantly. You know, oils that you, that smell good to you today, that taste good to you today, you know, 5 minutes from now could be, something that you're repelled by. It's really an expression of the imbalances in your body. So we take what oils, you respond to at any given moment and use those. You can do just a natural blend of them and inhale them for a time. You can take aromatic baths. You can use them for massage. It's very effective in massage to go into the body, whether it's absorption through the skin or you're inhaling them. It doesn't really matter. But those oils instantly go towards, like I said, the imbalances in your body that need to be healed.
Okay, but they go to the imbalance. What do they actually do to balance them? What's the physical reaction or the action that actually causes that balance we're dealing with?
You know, a lot of times because the oils are plant essences, you know, it's going towards neurochemicals, which interestingly a lot of your brain chemicals have a deep connection with or actually go back and forth between the large intestine, which is where the immune system sits, and a lot of your nervous system resides is right there. So the majority of the chemicals, or I should say the plant essences, will go there and, you know, really spike up your immune system. A lot of the times when we experience pain and imbalance in the body, it's because our immune system is compromised. It's busy working on, you know, if you ate a piece of meat, it's busy digesting that, or it's attacking other pathogens in the body. And so when we're weakened, obviously we come down with illness, and more imbalances are likely to manifest in various ways. This goes directly towards, like I said, neuro cells and also cells within the large intestine in your nervous system that are, you know, weakened.
Okay, so in essence, we have pathways in the body. And what in those neural pathways, there's a communication that goes on. You know, there's chemicals, there's messages coming to the brain to go to whatever that part of your body is that says function properly through your immune system. If there is a disconnect, and if the chemical isn't strong enough, it's not getting enough, then you're going to have that adverse reaction. And it could be stress, anxiety, any number of things causing disease also. So what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but what I'm hearing you say is through the oils and some of the processes that you're using, you open the pathways to allow the connection to take place that causes the body to work in a balanced way.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, so all right, that works. Now we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you, find some of the products, the services, and follow you?
Absolutely, yeah. My website is Hip to Be Whole. That's Hip, H-I-P, the number 2, the letter B, and Whole is spelled H-O-L, short for holistic.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I really believe if more people looked outside of allopathic medicine, and that doesn't mean that there's not a place for the kind of medicine, the traditional medicine or the conventional medicine that we're talking about, but for the most part, there are so many things out there and options that we don't even realize. So thank you so much for being here. We've appreciated your time and everything that you do.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free if you've got a question for me or the guest, whatever the case may be. 1-888-429-5471. That is 1-888-429-5471. And if you missed the show, it's in the archive, so go to BBS, and they've got them right there. Pam Mountfield with us, the author of Heartache to Harmony, The Boomerang Path to Empowering You in Love and in Life. She's a qualified neuropath, a kinesiologist, a personologist, which is a face reader, herbologist, and a counselor. Now, for over 26 years, she's been healing the broken hearts and empowering her patients with insights on themselves and others. And by reading faces, it reveals people's personality traits and their strengths, in addition to discovering who somebody's ideal partner would be. This saves a whole lot of time and money spent on dating sites or failed relationship choices. And let us say, Pam, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Michael, for having me on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Where were you when I got married the first time 326 years ago?
Working on my knowledge.
Yeah. Now, by the way, Pam, really when it comes down to it, that if we know certain things, let's say ahead of time, I think a lot of problems would not be there if we can anticipate and really know. You're right. It could be a lot of waste on the dating sites and this and that. And to really get down, to hone down what a perfect partner could be, would probably reduce here in the U.S. that 55%+ of first marriages that don't work out.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And I believe in the motto of prevention is better than cure. So using the traits talk, which is my style of reading one's face, which is looking at your facial features, you can get an insight into your personality and those of others. So you can start to be aligned to the type of person that's matched correctly to you, not what they put in their bio on a website.
Okay, let's look at a face for a moment. Now, when you take a look at a face, what are one of the first things that you see? You personally, what do you see?
The first trait that I look at is the eyes, because eyes are the windows to the soul, and the eyes tell you about emotionality, which means how emotional a person will be. So when you're talking with someone or looking at their photo, the eyes will give away how in-depth they'll be with their expressions of emotion, or how secretive or romantic they'll be.
Okay, now, the eyes, and then where do you go there? Where do you go from there?
Then I go down the nose and then towards the lips. So the nose gives me an indication if someone is directed towards being more of a people person, so they're motivated to being with people, helping people, or serving people, or sometimes it can indicate if they're very good in business.
Okay, now, moving from that, and I know we can get a lot of this out of the book, but moving from that, You talk about life is a boomerang. There's a question that I've asked people for years and years and years and years. And what it would say to them was, describe or define your mother emotionally. And they'd come up with an emotional description, not physically, but emotionally. And then I say, define your father emotionally. And they came up with that that description. Then I'd say, define your husband or your first husband or your wife or your first wife or whatever the case may be. And in 9 out of 10 times, Pam, you've got the same exact description. They didn't realize it, but it's the same thing. When you talk about boomerang, you could be with the same person 7 or 8 different times, but that person is in 7 or 8 different bodies.
Oh, totally. What I mean by that is, with the boomerang effect, it's like, until you learn your lessons or realize that you might be operating in someone else's belief system pattern, like that of your mother or your father, and then you choose a partner just how they did and have your marriage just how they did, then you'll keep attracting the same situation over and over. So it's really about, why is this happening to me again? And realizing that, hey, I can be my own individual here and not following someone else's, you know, programming. And then find someone that's absolutely rightly suited to you.
Let me give you a prime example of that. Now, this is our secret. We don't tell anybody about this, okay?
Okay.
Gotcha. All right. When I was 8 years old, my father died. And somebody once said to me years later, they said, your dad rejected you. And I said, how could he reject me? He wasn't there. He died. And they said, the opposite of acceptance is rejection. And then I began to realize the first 4 or 5 relationships that I really gotten into as an adult over the years, they all ended up with one thing happening. I forced them to leave. And when I say I forced them to leave, it was very unconscious. There's that mindset that somebody will leave me. So you take the step before they do it, and you make sure it happens. And what you get, the prize, is you get to prove yourself right about yourself. So truly, life is a boomerang.
That's absolutely true. And probably there's a small boy within you who doesn't want to go through that exact same pain again. So as an adult, you'll take the first step towards moving on so you don't experience that same pain again.
No, absolutely. How do you personally, when you're working with somebody, how do you go about, when you recognize that kind of a pattern in someone, how do you personally go about working with them? Let's say one of your clients, which will be named unnamed. How do you go about working with that person when they come in with those kind of symptoms and you know what it is and they don't? How do you deal with that? How do you bring it to the surface in a way that they can work with it, deal with it, and fix it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I work with that often in my clinic. I believe there are 8 steps. So the first step is reality. I get my patient to actually realize, well, where are you right now? And let's not be filled with guilt or worry, because that's when you're not in present time. And then I get them to realize, well, why did it happen? And maybe what was their part of a situation that helped to create that? And then thirdly, I go into the release phase, where I gently teach them exercises of how to release emotions and memories and, if you like, empty out the vessel of the old so you can fill up with new thoughts and beliefs about self. And then there's the reset phase, which is like where the boomerang is sort of coming back to you in a healthy way, that we can clear the belief systems and gain the new beliefs on now, like gives you the power to create new possibilities. Then they start to go forward into the fifth step, which is reclaiming their new sense of self and, you know, working with affirmations and positive beliefs. Then I help them to rebuild their body and mind as well as their spirit. So we look at the hormones, the lifestyle, nutrition, even feng shui to help build up their love nest. And then the realignment occurs when they've got their hologram right about how they would like their world to be. And that's where I bring in the traits talk to inform them of what an ideal partner could look like for them. And then finally, they're in that rejoice phase where they're feeling most empowered about their life that they can now create.
Okay, now let me ask you this. You mentioned something about an affirmation.
Yes,
Start with this. Let's go basic. What is an affirmation and what is the purpose of it?
An affirmation is to affirm a positive sentence or statement about yourself, often about what you are wanting to occur. But the most important thing is you must state it in the now language, like I now, da-da-da-dum. So you must put it into a very positive now sentence that brings about not only just a good positive thought form, but a new feeling. If you add the feeling of what that new direction is that you're acquiring, even that feeling sort of goes out as a ripple as well as what your own thoughts are creating.
Now, by the way, there's a word called believability. And years ago, when I first looked at an affirmation, it's probably 30, 35 years ago, when I looked at an affirmation, and somebody would say, you know, tell yourself that, you know, you're a powerful, good person. Well, for the most part, it's not believable to most people. And what I found with an affirmation, there was a particular way to do it. It's called a dialectical method, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. You have a theme. You know, that theme is I want to have a good life. And you begin with that thesis. And then you write down the emotional reaction from that thesis. Oh, no, you can't. You don't deserve it. And all the things I'm sure you've heard 1,000 times that cause you not to be able to experience that. And then there's the synthesis of the two. And what that does, it bridges that gap between that negative emotion and the affirmation that you started with. And what you end up with is something that'll fit your psychological makeup and be accepted, i.e., it's okay to be a good person now, or I can learn to be whatever it is. And I've learned over the years that it's very hard for people to accept a really good thought about themselves immediately. And if there is a strategy behind it and it's done in such a way that they begin to let go of the stuff that's holding it back, once they get it out, it's like journaling. One of the things I learned about that another 300 years ago was that you've got all of these things inside of you and it's causing the stress and the anxiety and everything else that's involved in it. But if you have a way to bring it out of you, put it on the table in front of you, and then all of a sudden you can take a subjective look at it, or an objective look at it, and see what it is and work with it. And then all of a sudden it gets externalized, and it gets externalized in a very safe place without judgment because it's in front of you.
Yeah, that's very true. And I guess for about 20 years that a lot of people were just programming words into their head, and their left brain was totally going, nah, don't believe this. This is not true. I came up about 15 years ago with symbol affirmation cards that I created for my patients to use and take home. And exactly what you were saying with the writing down of the negative emotions that come up is the first step you must do. You must empty out that inner critic, that sort of trash can that says, nah, you can't do this, nah, you're not worthy of that. Once you do that, then you can write out your positive sentence and you actually get a form of acceptance. And then I take it a step further where I get them to say the affirmation, and then I use kinesiology or muscle testing to anchor it in and make sure it's strong for that person. And then I add in symbols and color, because the subconscious mind loves to work with color and symbols. So I actually get people to doodle their affirmations, actually scribble symbols and colors and work with it subliminally, not just saying the words over and over again.
You know, when it comes down to that conscious, that subconscious mind, you know, most people talk about hypnosis when you're dealing with the unconscious mind. And I've asked people time and again, I would say, have you ever been hypnotized? And they'll say, no, absolutely not. And then the response is, have you ever gone to a show, to a movie? Have you ever gone to a movie and cried? Have you ever gone to a movie and got angry? Have you ever gone to a movie and fell in love? You know, you've got a screen, you know it's not real, but you've got suggestive ideas triggering all of these emotions inside of you. So the word is absolutely. And I really believe what I'm hearing you say, which is dynamite stuff, is that it's you're bringing down that receptiveness to all of those outside variables that cause the problems that they're running around in.
Oh, totally. I mean, with people who are living on borrowed belief systems and so influenced by what the world wants to tell them or advertising wants to tell them, they lose a sense of their own identity. So it really is about finding what really is true to you, what is your own core. And if you are living on other people's feelings and emotions because of what has happened in the past, then you'll be far more open to suggestibility and then end up, you know, walking a path or dating a person or being not true to yourself.
Oh, no question about it. Because when we really come down to it, what did I hear somebody say? It was something to the effect of, our need for love is so great that we'll bend to the wants and the needs of others, and then we're not ourselves anymore because we want to be accepted and loved so much that we're going to be somebody else's definition of what we should be like. And that's when it gets stuffed, and that's when the misery starts. And I hate to say this, but there's so many people, Pam, they go through life like this, and they never get that shot to say, I don't have to do this.
Oh, totally. I very much believe that love is the strongest emotion, especially unconditional love. And that begins with yourself first. You really can't love another person until you truly love yourself unconditionally. So the only person who can change how you can feel is you. It's not because you're in a new relationship or a new job or got a new pair of shoes. These things only momentarily distract you from your feelings. So when you really, truly begin to accept yourself as now, then you can grow and heal and let this love flow through you, and then happiness and joy will fill up that energetic space, and then you'll start to attract love back. And there's a lovely quote I'd like to say from a wise woman who said, "Nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent."
No, absolutely.
That was Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And one other thing where the kinesiology is so critically important, we're starting to run out of time, but it's your unconscious mind will talk to you through your body. And one of the ways that you do it, I'm not sure which method you use, but I could stand here with, let's say, my right arm completely extended, and you can ask me a yes or no question, truth or not. And if it drops, it's a no. If it stays up there, it's a yes. You can do the same thing with your hand also. So if you know which part of the body to work with, you can actually get your answers from your subconscious mind.
Absolutely. I mean, I've used this for 26 years in my clinic, and I'd rather ask the body and the inner mind of what is going on than just talking to a person's head and hearing their belief systems answer me. So, yeah, I love demonstrating with think of a negative emotion or get into a state of feeling hateful and angry, push on the arm and the arm will go weak. But think of something joyful or happy or peaceful and your arm will be strong, which absolutely shows that your emotions have power over you and flow through you.
No question about it. No, by the way, we're out of time. Let me ask you this, Pam. Is there a website we can find you at? And also, when is the book going to be out?
Oh, my book will be printed by April this year. And my website is www.destinyhealthservices.com. Or you can email me, please, on kinesio, K-I-N-E-S-I-O, at tpg.com.au. And I'd love for any of the callers to request to get 10 top tips for stress, and I'll talk about a couple of traits that I could teach you about finding love.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, Pam, thank you so much for your time. I've appreciated every minute of it, and everything you're saying is absolutely spot on.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll warm up with a knife. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a long time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Oh, that's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover. true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Amy Rommel with us is currently an attorney at Hogan Lovells U.S. LLP in Washington, D.C., where she specializes in nuclear energy matters, particularly matters involving the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, and the Department of Energy. She frequently consults NRC reactor licenses, materials licenses, and vendors on compliance with NRC requirements. She also advises clients on NRC licensing matters, including new plant licensing and the NRC safety and environmental requirements. And let us say, Amy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. There is so much that so many of us do not understand about energy and the process of what goes on now, what could go on, and that the politics behind either moving a piece of it forward or bringing it back. If you had the proverbial magic wand and you could control everything in the country, they had to do exactly what you said. Amy, how would you deal with it? How would you create the any of the nuclear issues in such a way that they would benefit us and not there wouldn't be battles over it? I know that's a tough question.
Well, there's a lot of eggs in that basket. I'd say, first of all, if I had some magic wand that enables me to get past politics, that yeah. I think it's important to stress that we need a diverse energy portfolio. We don't want to build all nuclear or all wind farms or all coal plants. We need to ensure that we have a broad array of power generation sources across the board. With specifically with respect to nuclear, I think that the biggest problems facing nuclear energy are, number one, a lot of people don't know that much about it. And it certainly came to the forefront of people's mind after the Fukushima event. But I found that after Fukushima, I was answering a lot of questions that I thought people already knew. And so I think that what I would probably do was increase awareness of nuclear energy, how it's generated and how it works. And then probably the other issue facing nuclear energy is storage of spent fuel. And let me tell you that if I had a magic wand to handle politicians, I'd yeah. solve the spent fuel problem, that's for sure. That's what's holding it up is politics.
Okay, but what is it, in, when we say politics is holding it up, what is it basically? Who? Because we know politics today, it's nothing more than who's right and who's wrong. And you and I, as the constituents, we usually get the raw end of the deal. But when you look at it politically, what is it that's stopping the proper use of nuclear energy?
Well, specifically with respect to spent fuel, I think the problem with coming up with a permanent solution for what to do with our spent fuel, it's such a hot political matter that every time there's a new president in office or new senators in office or whatnot, the previous administration's resolution of the issue is all of a sudden is deemed unresolved and it gets revisited. For example, the Yucca Mountain spent fuel repository that was proposed to be built in Yucca Mountain, Nevada, the Department of Energy had selected that site and had submitted an application to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to construct a permanent nuclear waste deep geologic repository for spent nuclear fuel and have it all located at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And it would have taken all the spent fuel that was currently stored on site at the various 104 operating nuclear power plants, some decommissioned plants as well, and move it to one location that can be monitored and whatnot. And then, you know, when President Obama came into office, he decided that Yucca Mountain was no longer going to be the avenue that we pursued, even though we've been pursuing it for years. And, you know, Yucca Mountain has become the most heavily studied piece of real estate in the world. And he creates a Blue Ribbon Commission. And the Blue Ribbon Commission is supposed to figure out what to do with nuclear waste. The Blue Ribbon Commission is one of many Blue Ribbon Commissions that have already been formed before and have already studied the same issue, and they came out with many of the same recommendations as previous Blue Ribbon commissions about what to do with it. And it looks like in the meantime,
you know, to advance the ball forward, we may get interim storage facilities that are located in various spots throughout the United States, maybe two or three spots, before we end up with a permanent repository. But it's just slowed the ball a little bit. And if we could remove the issue from the political arena so that it could just get resolved, you know, outside of politics, then I think that it wouldn't really be an issue at all.
Okay, but we're talking about the repository, and obviously what you said, the commission after commission after commission came up with the same concepts, the same ideas. They came up with the same end result, and yet at the same time, the administration is not doing anything with it. Where do you think the holdup is? What is that something against the repository? What's the debate about? What drives the debate from the administration that says, no, we have to wait?
Well, the debate that how Yucca Mountain came into play is the Blue Ribbon Commission is currently underway. Its report is expected to come out at the end of this month, but I reviewed its draft report, which came out in July, and they made the same recommendations as other Blue Ribbon commissions, but they didn't say you should put it at Yucca Mountain, which is what had previously been our nuclear waste policy. And the reason, you know, I can speculate on this, but
sure.
I would say that perhaps one of the reasons that Yucca Mountain is no longer on the table is that Harry Reid is a strong political ally. And when you're running for president and Harry Reid is strongly opposed to Yucca Mountain, then maybe you make some concessions and agreements. And then when you come to office, that's what happens when you get into office. So I think that it's no longer Yucca Mountain because the delegation from Yucca Mountain did not necessarily want it to be there.
Okay, so effectively it's based on that consensus that if you want us behind you, you do what we tell you to do, or you're not going to get our support. I mean, really, that's what you're saying when it comes down to, you know, in a nutshell. But let's talk about the nuclear energy. If we were to have the choice of energy, in your opinion, with all your research, your study, is nuclear energy, and this is a question, I have nothing behind it, is nuclear energy the way to go?
I would say that if you want to generate significant amounts of power, that nuclear energy is definitely the way to go. If you're looking for just kind of smaller amounts of power, you know, say you're a small municipality and you're just looking to generate some power, then maybe you consider small and modular reactors, which is a kind of a new type of nuclear reactor that's being developed. But if you want large-scale power and you need power supplied 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, then nuclear is definitely a great way to go. It's the only other comparisons for what's called baseload power, and that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week power generation, are coal and natural gas. And I think environmentally speaking, nuclear doesn't generate any greenhouse gas emissions in the process of generating nuclear power. And so 75% of the power that's generated in the United States that's greenhouse gas free is from nuclear energy. So if you want to make a significant environmental impact while significantly contributing to baseload power, then nuclear energy is a great way to go.
Okay, let's say that we wave the wand and we're going to go nuclear energy. From today, how long would it take us to implement?
Well, we actually already have a significant number of applications for new reactors pending at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NRC has a process called a combined operating license application, where the NRC issues a construction permit and an operating license to applicants. And the NRC has received, in the last few years, has received about 18 applications for 26 new reactors in the United States. So assuming we're using one of those applications, then I'd probably say when you take that time for the application process and then time to construct the plant, you're going to be looking about an eight-year time frame.
Okay. So realistically, We probably have a few years before anyone could make up any kind of a decision close to this. So if I were to say we're looking 15, 20 years away, do you think I'd be in the realm of reality?
Well, it depends what area you're looking at. For example, there's two COL applications that look like they're about to get their their licenses from the NRC, the Vogel plant and the summer plant in the southeast United States should be getting their COL permits from the NRC probably in the next by the end of the month or at the beginning of next month. So then you'd have to construct those plants, and they'd be up and running in just a few years from now.
Okay,
so
now let's talk
Wisconsin. Way off into the future goal.
Okay, let's talk Wisconsin. Where is the benefit for Wisconsin at this moment in time with all of the variables that come into play? Where would Wisconsin benefit by that nuclear energy?
Well, Wisconsin would benefit. I'm just looking at kind of the breakdown of power sources in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin gets 65% of its electricity is generated from coal, 10% from natural gas, and 20% is from nuclear. You know, keeping in mind the environmental discussion that we had a few minutes earlier, if Wisconsin increases its nuclear power generation, then it could significantly decrease its greenhouse gas emissions that's generated by the coal and natural gas power sources.
Okay, so if we look at this, and realistically, when we take a look at everything that you're talking about, Amy, what you're saying is spot on. And what you're saying is if we could do this, if we could do this conversion into more and more nuclear energy, it would be safer, number one. And the end result, it would be a lot cheaper for everybody. And for some reason, it's not happening. And I guess if you go back to the old adage that if you follow the money, you're going to find the answer, what's holding it back. And so I think if we look at that and attack that, there's that old adage that you can't take a knife to a gunfight. You got to fight fire with fire. So if you know what the battle is, you know what your opponent is, then you go at it that way. But I think for the most part, without people like yourself, most people have no idea who the opponent is out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we're talking about Wisconsin specifically, if you're trying to figure out, you know, why is there not new nuclear build in Wisconsin? Because many other states are exploring or in the process of new nuclear builds, you know, just as evidenced by the number of applications that the NRC has. Wisconsin has in place a moratorium on new reactors that provides that a new plant cannot be built unless it's economically advantageous to the ratepayer compared to feasible alternatives. Fine. But then the second provision is that a new plant cannot be built until a federally licensed repository for high-level nuclear waste is operating with enough capacity to hold the waste from the power plants in Wisconsin. So assuming that legislation is not changed, then as I just told you, you know, the high-level waste repository has been yet again delayed, even though it was very close to getting licensed and constructed. So as long as that repository is not built, then Wisconsin's not going to have any more nuclear power.
And realistically,
more than it does now.
Yeah, and Wisconsin is nothing more than a symbol of every other state in the country. So realistically, that's what it's about. Okay, now let me ask you this. What's your purpose of being
out? Quick correction. I'm sorry, Michael. I'm not trying to interrupt you, but the difference between Wisconsin and other states is that most other states don't have in place that moratorium.
Oh, okay. All right. I know I hear you loud and clear. Now, what's your purpose for being on the air? How can people get behind you? What is it? What's the message you want to get across?
The message that I want to get across, first of all, the purpose for me being on the air is I'm a volunteer for an organization that just goes and you know, talks to people about nuclear energy just to provide them with more information. So I have no other ulterior motive besides that. But the purpose of this phone call and what the message I want to get across would be is that nuclear energy is a clean, safe, affordable, and reliable form of power generation, and that it should be part of any energy portfolio moving forward. The Energy Information Administration, which is part of the Department of Energy, has predicted that we need 24% new more electricity by 2035 in order to sustain economic growth. And in order to meet those needs, you're going to need to contribute. You're going to need to have baseload power generation, and nuclear is a great way to do that while at the same time not compromising the environment.
Okay, and that makes sense. Now, how can I, as the average citizen, help out with this?
Well, you could always contact your legislature if you feel like there should be more nuclear power. But in addition, if you're looking for more information, you could go to the Clean Energy for America website. That's the organization that I volunteer with to get more information about nuclear energy. And then I think it's important to make sure that it's part of the discussion when people are talking about energy needs moving forward. You know, it's important to look at renewable energy, and it's important to have discussions about wind power and solar power and how good those can be for the environment. But I think it's critical not to forget nuclear energy when you're having those same discussions.
Oh, sure. No question about it. All right. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and get more information?
Sure. The organization that I volunteer with is the Clean Energy 4, that's the number 4, America.org. And that's a great place to find additional information on nuclear energy. The NRC's website actually also has a ton of information on nuclear energy, including what the NRC is doing post-Fukushima for U.S. plants. And the NEI website is www.nei.org, and that also has great information as well.
Wonderful. Hey, Amy Roma, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I'd do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're for you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Kathleen McHugh with us. She is the co-author of How to Help Children Through a Parent's Serious Illness, Supportive Practical Advice from a Leading Child Life Specialist, as she's created a pioneering program aimed at helping children through a parent's medical crisis. When she was the Child Life Director at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation. Now, since 2000, she's been the Director of Children's Programs at the Gathering Place, Cleveland's community-based support center for families fighting cancer. She's appeared on the Today Show, Sunday Today, and among other national outlets, sharing her wisdom with families in need. Kathleen, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. Thanks very much for having me today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, Kathleen, when we really deal with something like this, who is prepared? How do you deal with a 4-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old to say there's a serious illness here and we might lose this parent? I mean, obviously, that's got to be a tough thing to sit down. And are they going to be aware? Are they going to be able to grasp it on the other side?
Oh, yeah. It's one of the hardest tasks a parent or family members ever have to undertake, is to help a child work their way through one of their parents being seriously ill and perhaps facing death. And, you know, certainly many people can become seriously ill and survive and go on with their lives, but that the fear that comes up when you're facing a serious illness like this is just huge for the adult and also for the child.
And no question about it, but that there's a twofold problem here for the adult. One is obviously the potential loss of their loved one, and the other one is, let's say, threefold. One is to communicate it to their child, and then secondarily, while you're going through the grief yourself, if that person dies, how do you handle the grief of the child at the same time? And is it, you know, can you just put your grief aside and say, okay, we're going to work with the child? In many cases, I don't think that's really possible.
It's very hard. And obviously, there are lots of professionals that can step in and be of assistance to parents. But really, a child trusts their parent more than anyone else. So that's the person that you want to empower, that we try to empower to help their own children. I think the first issue that parents face is it's such a natural impulse for a parent to want to protect their child from bad news. So when a couple or, you know, even a single parent is facing a serious diagnosis, their first tendency is, let's not tell the children, let's not talk to the children, we can keep this from the children. But the reality is, it's very, very difficult to do that. And children always know that something's going on in the family. They see worry on their parents' faces, they find a parent crying in the bedroom, they overhear a conversation on the telephone. Almost every child that I meet with tells me they knew something was going on. And often they've heard words that the parent was sure that their child would never have heard. So we really can't hide it. The best way to help children thrive through this kind of experience is to be as honest as you can, paying attention always to the age and the developmental level of the child. Be as honest as you can. Give children hope when you can, when there is actual hope to be held on to, and then help prepare them step by step for what's going to change and impact their lives. And if you can do that, even if the outcome is that horrible outcome of losing a loved one, losing a parent, if you can prepare them and support them through the process, they will be able to go on safely with their lives. And that's what every parent wants, is a child that can move forward and have a healthy future and a healthy life.
Kathleen, I got Radio Susie here, Susan Greenman, and I'm going to turn her mic on. She went through this exact same thing. Susie, take the mic.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm so happy to have you with us tonight. You know, there's also another dimension that I like to add. What do you do when the seriously ill parent doesn't totally support how you should tell your child what's going on? For example,
That's a very common situation. Go ahead.
I'm going to use one example, and that was chemotherapy. And I said to my husband, we should really prepare Samantha for somehow, you know, when your hair starts coming out and all of a sudden you're bald.
Right. And what did he say?
He did not want to discuss it. He didn't want me to tell her. And it was, so boy, was that difficult, because you couldn't prevent that from happening. And, you know, you're being tugged in so many directions.
Oh, I know. And it's so hard when parents don't see kind of the same ultimate goals. There's an example of this in the book that we wrote, How to Help Children Through a Parent's Serious Illness, where I talk about a mom who wanted to tell her two children about their father's very serious illness and the fact that things were not looking well and that he could die, and the father absolutely refusing to tell the children. And I remember going into his room in the hospital and talking to him about this, and he kept, like, avoiding. When I would say, your children probably already know something serious is going on, he'd say, well, if they already know, we don't need to talk to them. And then I would say, but they're probably really scared about what's going on, and he would say, but I don't want to scare them anymore. So no matter what I said, he had a kind of comeback that was protective of the children. And then I think I said one more thing to him, and he finally sort of yelled at me, don't you understand? If I tell my children that I could die, it means I'm going to. And then I got it. He was so afraid face this reality, to face leaving his family, leaving his children, leaving his wife. He just couldn't talk about it. And basically what we did in that situation was talking to the mom. She could not live with not preparing her children. And so we agreed that it would be okay if she prepared her children as long as they understood that their daddy could not talk about it right now. And actually, over time, he was able to. Over the next week or so, he was able to talk to his children. But her needs to prepare her children for what was going to happen were met, and his needs to not have to face his children and discuss this topic were also met. And I think that's sometimes the only thing you can do.
Kathleen, how old were those children?
As I recall, at that point, they were 5 or 6 and 8 or 9, in that range.
Okay.
Two children, a little boy and a little girl. So it's very hard. And lots of times I'm put in the position, working with families, of meeting with both parents and trying to help them talk out what's in the best interest of their children. How can they help their children get through this? What do they want for their children? And lots of times parents truly believe that they can protect their children from this information. I think sometimes parents just hearing, look, your children are going to have to face challenges in their lives. There's no way you can protect them from that. And this particular challenge with you guys both talking to your children and supporting your children, it gives you the opportunity to give your children the skills to cope in their future life with tough times. You wouldn't have wished for this. You would have never asked for this. But here it is. Take advantage of it. Give your children a lesson that they will be able to use for the rest of their lives, which is, when bad things happen, how can I get through them with strength, with success? And that sometimes helps parents to see their role.
Sure. Kathleen, let me ask you this. Have you found with all of your work an overarching theme, a problem that you know when those parents sit down with you that you know you're going to hear? Is there one of those common denominator problems that is just the essence of what causes them to feel the way they do?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the thing that I hear most, and it's sort of what we were just talking about, is when parents come in, especially after a new diagnosis, for example, it's, well, what words do I use? How do I tell my children? You know, what if I can't do their activities with them? All those things get discussed. And then there's always a quiet moment. And then they say something like, and what if my child asks me if I'm going to die? What do I say? And that is, I think, the core of the fear that parents have, is that that question is going to get asked and that they are not going to have a clue how to handle it, and they're going to do it wrong, or they're going to be put in a position of saying something that's incorrect. It's just terrifying for a parent.
Okay,
no
question about it, Kathleen. Let's do a practical thing here. I am 9 years old. I'm 9 years old. My dad's going to die. How do you tell me that? And just to give everybody an idea of how you would approach it, because I know there's so much more in the book, and you know, how to help your children through parents' serious illness, but just as a practical, this is one of the ways to do it.
Okay, so here's what to remember first. Nobody knows. I don't know. You don't know. The doctors don't know, and they'll say they don't know when someone's going to die or if someone's necessarily going to die. Everyone who has a serious illness has statistics, and those statistics may say only 1% of people survive this disease, but 1% of people do survive this disease. So the likelihood is that someone is going to die. It's probably going to be sometime in the future, but if you're 9 years old, Michael, and your dad or your mom has just been diagnosed with a serious illness, then I'm not going to tell you that 6 months down the road or a year down the road, your mom or your dad is going to die, because you don't have any concept of what 6 months or a year means. What we're going to talk about is your mom is really seriously ill, and or your dad or whoever in your family, and these are the things the doctor's going to do. And if you at 9, and you might at 9, ask me, well, is my mom or my dad going to die? What I'm going to say to you is, this is a really serious illness. This is an illness that people can die from, but not everybody does die from this, and your mom or your dad are fighting really hard and doing everything the doctors are saying and doing their very best to get well. And all we can do right now is hope that the things that the doctors are trying and the nurses and all the healthcare people are trying with your mom and your dad are going to work. And that I can promise you that if we ever know that those things are not working, if there comes a time when the doctors say, there's nothing more we can do, then we'll tell you that and we'll tell you the truth. If you want to know the truth, do you want to know the truth? Most children say yes, not all,
sure.
But most. So it would be a conversation like that.
Yeah, and see, that's leading to the possibility, and I think that's the most important word
right.
We can deal with. It's possible. It can, and I heard you say can. It can happen. You're not scaring that child beyond whatever because you're not saying it's going to happen. It can happen. It's that first step of preparation.
Right. And then the next step is, for example, in the very end chapter of our book talks about a situation where three little girls' father was dying, and he knew he could at some point in the future, didn't know when, didn't know for sure, but when finally it came to be a reality, he did tell his daughters that he hoped he would have some time with them. He hoped he would have some really good days with them, but that he knew that this disease was going to cause him to die at some point. And at that point, it wasn't very long away. He had about a month from that point. And he said to them, so now what we're hoping for, we're not hoping that I'm going to live from this disease anymore because we know that can't happen. What we're going to hope for is that every day we do something special together. Every day we tell each other that we love each other. Every day we cuddle and we hug and we watch a funny movie together. And every day you talk to me about what your hopes and dreams are, and I talk to you about what kind of a young woman I want you to grow up to be. They had those. I mean, he was an amazingly brave man because he could have those conversations with his girls. But he changed the hope, which you don't want to ever completely take away, from hope of survival to hope of good quality time, peaceful time, loving time, and whatever time is left. And that's when it's the best that it can be, that's how it looks.
Kathleen, you know what? It's an absolute shame that people don't do that anyway, without that possibility of, you know, a mom or dad going. And I, you know, every once in a while, those kind of thoughts run through me, and I run down the hall, and there's, you know, 5,000 dogs and 1,200 cats over here. And I'll make sure I'll stop in the middle of the night and I'll pet one of them, because who knows if you're going to be able to pet them tomorrow.
Oh, that's such a beautiful and important point in all this, is the things that help families to get through this hardest, darkest time, this end-of-life time, are the things we should be paying attention to all the time, which is making the most of every moment, letting people know you love them, being generous, being caring, all of that.
Absolutely, no question about it. Kathleen, we're just about out of time. Website, please, we can find you at.
You can reach me directly at my place of work, which is my last name, McCue, McCue, at touchedbycancer.org. And this book that's really a manual for families to deal with these kinds of situations can be obtained at any bookstore, on any, you know, normal bookseller website.
Wonderful. And we're going to have you come back on with the Touch from Cancer program. Anyways, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate what you're doing, and the book is brilliant because there's so many people who just don't know what to do.
That's right. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Kathleen, thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Let's go sailing somewhere beyond the sea. She's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on a high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing. It is far beyond the stars, it is near beyond the moon. I know beyond a doubt my heart will lead me there soon. We'll meet beyond the shore
We'll kiss just as before. Happy we'll be beyond the sea. And never again I'll go sailing. As before, and happy we'll be beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
So long sailing, bye bye sailing.
Dr. William Lastick with us, MD. He's the co-author of Why Women Need Fat, How Healthy Foods Make Us Gain Excess Weight, and The Surprising Solution to Lose It Forever. He's a former assistant surgeon general as an assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Graduate School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh, and research assistant at the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, and that's in Santa Barbara. Will, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Hi.
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we take a look at it, we hear this word fat all the time. Let's start with the definition, lay a base, and we can work up from there. What is fat? What's the purpose of it in your body in the first place?
Well, that's actually the question that was bothering us when we started out. We first got involved when we were trying to figure out the question of why men universally admire women with hourglass figures, why they admire the fat in women's legs and hips and don't seem to like it in women's waists. And we were quite surprised when we did a little more research to find that women really have an astonishing amount of fat compared with other animals, about 7 times as much. And just to give you an example of how that works, let's say we go back about 40 years before the American obesity epidemic, and at that time an average woman in her late teens would weigh about 120 pounds, about 20 pounds less than she weighs today or than a woman in Europe weighs. So how much, most of us would probably agree that that's a pretty slender woman, 120 pounds, and that woman would have 35 pounds of fat, about one-third of her body weight would be fat, whereas animals only have about 5% fat, and that's more than twice as much as men. So that was the big mystery that we were trying to figure out, is why do women have so much fat compared with other animals? And one clue was that we know that women can't have their periods if their fat levels go too low. So that led us to the idea that it probably has something to do with having babies. Now, today, women can do any job they want, but if their bodies weren't really good at having babies, then none of us would be here. So we were trying to figure out, well, what is it about our babies that are different from the babies of other animals? And that 7 times figure comes right back to play, because our brain is about 7 times bigger than the brain of other animals. And our brain has about 10% of a particular kind of fat called DHA, and a particular omega-3 fat. And the DHA in our baby's brains, it comes during a woman's pregnancy or while she nurses, all comes from her fat. So, and that omega-3 has to come from her diet because we can't make it. We can't make any omega-3 fat. And if we compare American women with women in other countries, and we can do that by looking at how much DHA there is in their milk, American women have just about the lowest DHA of any women in the world. And so if a diet is very low in omega-3, the only way you can have more omega-3 in your fat is to have more fat, because the percentage in your fat reflects what's in the diet. So that gives us one clue as to why American women are so much heavier today than they were 40 years ago.
Now, by the way, one of the things I've learned over the years, and I'm not a clinician, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a weight specialist, that said, but there's something called muktuk. Muktuk up in Alaska is whale blubber, which is fat, which the natives up there to the area eat a lot of during the winter times for survival. And I have found over the years that fat, for some reason, constitutes survival. And if you take a look at what's going on in this country today with the obesity problem, not just overweight, but the obesity problem, there is a lot of emotionally unprotected people out there that are stuffing themselves because that's the only way they can get emotionally filled up as opposed to what else isn't coming up. So is that not, Will, a variable to take a look at?
It certainly could be a factor, and it could be that our lives today are a lot different than they were 40 years ago. But 40 years ago, American women weighed 20 to 25 pounds less than they do today, or than European women weigh today. And it would be hard to say that American women have a much more difficult life than European women. But there is a really big difference in our diet and the diet that we had 40 years ago, or the diet that women have in Europe today. So we think that probably a really important factor is the differences in our diet that have occurred over this last 40 years.
All right, so they're with fat now, and from what you're saying through your research, there's good fat and there's bad fat. What is
That's good, right.
Fat? What is the kind of fat that somebody can eat and actually lose weight?
Actually, the same omega-3 fat that we were just talking about that's good for brains is also good for weight. And if we measure the amount of DHA in women's blood, the women who have the most DHA have the lowest weight. So omega-3 fat is actually promotes low weight. And it's very good for lots of other reasons. So it's a win-win-win situation all around. And the best form of omega-3 is DHA, and the best sources of DHA are fish and seafood. Now, the problem with fish and seafood, unfortunately, today, is that they're contaminated with mercury. And so for many of us, and especially for women, because mercury is more dangerous for them, fish oil and fish oil in capsules or fish oil liquid is probably a good choice because fish oil is chemically purified to remove the mercury. Omega-3 eggs are also a very good source of DHA, and canola oil is a high in, and also flaxseed oil are high in a more basic form of omega-3.
Okay, so in essence, if we eat the right thing, obviously it's healthy for us. Now, the right kind of fat, if they find it, but what else do they do? They find the right kind of fat. What else do they do to drop the weight? Or is it the fat, and this is a question now, is it the fat that will be the stimulator to get everything started, the good fat?
Well, it turns out that, as we were saying, there's good fat, bad fat, and there's an omega-3 has an evil twin. And the evil twin is called omega-6. It's not something we hear as much about as omega-3. But omega-6 fat has gone way, way up in our diets. Back in the Stone Age times, there were about the same amount of omega-6 and omega-3 today we have about more than 20 times as much omega-6 than omega-3 in our diets. And the reason for that is because of two changes that have occurred in our diet. One is that we have an enormous amount of soybean and corn oil in what we eat today. It's gone up three times in the last 40 years, and it amounts to 540 calories a day for every man, woman, and child, so which is quite a lot of calories just coming from two forms of vegetable oil. And we don't see that oil most of the time because it's in processed and prepared foods. So that's one reason the omega-6 is very high. The other reason is that we used to feed our animals grass. They would go out in the pasture and nibble on the grass, and they would be fed hay in the winter. And all that changed in the last 40 years, so that most animals now stay in one place and they're fed corn. And because corn is very high in omega-6, while grass is high in omega-3, the meat that we eat, at least the regular supermarket meat that most of us eat, is very high in omega-6 and very low in omega-3, and especially the most important forms. And it's also affected the regular eggs that we eat. They're now much lower in omega-3 and much higher in omega-6. So those are the changes in our diet which have contributed to gaining weight. The decrease in omega-3 and this big, big increase in omega-6. So if both of these are important, they both have an independent effect on our weight. So we need to increase omega-3, and we also need as much as we can to decrease the omega-6 fat.
Okay, now why, and obviously I don't think there's going to be an answer to this question, but why, with all of the diets that we see, all of the programs that people are using to lose weight, why isn't this some of the base of that, that doesn't get included in the diets themselves?
Well, most of the diets that women use are weight loss diets. So they're designed to have fewer calories. And they usually actually cut back on fat because fat is a major source of calories. The problem is, and this is something that it's very hard to convince people of, but there's really an abundance of evidence that these weight loss diets don't work. They might work for a small number of people, but for most women, most women will tell you that they've dieted many times in their lives, and that over a period of time that they've been doing this, they've been gaining weight, and that is pretty much the universal experience. And there have been many studies done in which they start out from scratch, and then over a period of time, they find out which women have dieted the most and which women have dieted the least. And they find those studies all show that the women who diet more gain more weight. So cutting calories is not a good way to lose weight. Now, what happens is you do lose weight during the diet, but our brains are designed to make us stay at the same weight. So as soon as the diet is over, our weights come back up, but they don't only come back up to where they were. They actually go up more. A little bit more each time we diet. So the end result is that we gain more and more weight. And that's another reason why American women are heavier today, because they diet much more than they did in the past. When I was a kid growing up in the 50s and 60s, nobody talked about dieting. There weren't any dieting books. There weren't any dieting plans. There weren't any Weight Watchers. These things didn't exist, and yet women weighed 20, 25 pounds less than they do today on average, and obesity was much less frequent. So it wasn't because the women back then were dieting. It was because they were eating a different kind of diet.
Oh, no question about it, because we won't tell anybody, but that's when I grew up. I was born in the early 40s, and I basically grew up in the 50s and the young adult in the 60s. But what I saw was the same thing that you saw. There were people who were overweight. There's no question about it. But nothing like there is today. The culture go ahead.
I was just going to say, you didn't see women out jogging when you were a kid either, right?
No, they didn't have to, for the most part.
Right. There wasn't much exercise. There weren't any exercise programs for women in those days. There weren't many sports for women. But despite the fact that we exercise a lot more today, it's still these changes in our diet have made such a big difference that it's hard to overcome even by exercising more.
Oh, no question. Well, we're starting to run out of time. Website where we can actually find you at. And by the book.
The title of our book, Why Women Need Fat. Our book is available on Amazon and from the Penguin website and in bookstores.
Wonderful. Hey, Will Lysak, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Interesting take on it. I think you got a lot here. And
Thank you.
Again,
thank you for having me.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Chad Kennedy with his PhD. He's the author of Spiritual Evolution, How Science Redefines Our Existence. He holds a PhD and an MS in bioengineering, a BS in mechanical engineering. He was the co-founder, president, and CEO of Restorative Biosciences, Inc. Has worked in various design, testing, and training capacities at NASA, the Johnson Space Center. And Dr. Kennedy currently serves as the chair and adjunct professor of the Biomedical Engineering Technology Program at DeVry University. He's the author, again, of Spiritual Evolution, How Science Redefines Our Existence. Chad, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When you deal with spirituality, the spiritual evolution, science, if you want to define science, science basically says it science means it's provable. And there are so many things that we're so lost at, but when we deal with it, do we really, is our existence really defined? Do we really have scientific evidence of where we started and how we got to where we are?
That is a big question.
I know.
And that's exactly why I dove into writing the book in the first place, was because I was interested in that very question. there are several things, obviously, that we have not proven and we don't know. What I did try to find are little elements or nuggets of things that we are finding out in science and different discoveries in different realms of science that may give us some hints, some insights as to what are some plausible explanations and what are some things that just don't make any sense. So just to give you an idea, the book follows along two pathways. The first part of the book is really trying to get people open to the possibility that there may be explanations other than what we've been told in our childhood or, you know, fairy tales or even other traditional belief systems and things like that, which is very hard for a lot of people, of course. And then the second part of the book really starts diving into this evidence question. If we're open to the idea, what evidence is out there, and what are some things that again, give us some hints of what's really going on behind the scenes?
Sure. Now, by the way, let me jump in just for a minute. I remember years ago, I've told the story once or twice on the air over, you know, a period of time, but I was in Southern California, which is where I was brought up. I'm on the beach one night, and it's one of those gorgeous summer nights. You got a million stars out there, and I'm laying on the beach. I'm looking up at the stars, and there's music playing, and it's really a great place to be. And then I started thinking, which was the big mistake. I started thinking of what's
that's how it begins.
I know. I started thinking, what's beyond the stars, and then what's beyond the beyond, and it's got to end someplace. My linear mind said, there's a beginning, there's an end. But then the thought hit me was, how could there be an end? And then it took me to another place. About this time, I'm starting to get scared. And it took me to another place, and I thought, how can anybody define the undefinable? Because there's answers mm-hmm. we can't get because it goes beyond our reach, our grasp, and our ability to mm-hmm. see an end result. And then the thought hit me, spirituality, what's God? And if you can define the undefinable, mm-hmm. you may have a problem here. So that really turned me around, and I started looking at things completely different, Chad, from that point forward. It's what is it, and how do you prove the unprovable?
Right. And it's baffling. For instance, in the case of, you know, where is the end and all those kind of things, science has kind of put a pretty clear line, mostly in the realm of physics, as to what is knowable as far as what we can measure. And so we usually quantify it in something that's measurable. As far as we have now, our measurements are usually based in astronomical measurements and things that we can see to early back in time, because every time the further we look out, we're actually looking into the past. And the further we look into the past, it gets us to about 13.7 or approximately 14 billion years ago. And this is where they come up with that time frame of what they would call the Big Bang. Now, of course, the Big Bang is a beginning, but it's ironic that you find, you know, something akin to a beginning when you're looking for the end. So that's just a whirlwind all in itself. With that regard, when we're trying to understand these types of concepts, we have to then ask ourselves, okay, well, if we can only see so much and we can only measure certain things, because we usually only have certain types of instruments that we can do this with, many of which are in electromagnetic spectrum, then outside of, like you said, what is measurable is really outside the purview of anything we can absolutely know. So what that kind of gives rise to also in a philosophical argument is God, let's say, and in the book I actually use the term source. I actually borrowed that from Dr. Wayne Dyer. The reason I use source is because it's not tied to any particular dogma. You know, when you use the term God or use the term Allah, it's going to have a lot of connotations with that word. So that seemed to be a good neutral word to use. So if we're trying to take a model of, let's say, source, we can look at it in two manners is what it seems to be predominant when I was looking through the literature. One is there can be a manifest God model of the universe, and then the other one is a unmanifest God model of the universe. And so let's quickly explain what that means. An unmanifest God model of the universe is kind of the idea that God is external to this universe, and hence, like you said, what's beyond the stars, what's beyond, you know, the end. that would make an assumption that God is something outside of the universe and basically just set the initial conditions, whether it's a Big Bang or some people hypothesize it's a Big Bounce instead of a bang. And if that's the case, then you're right. We can't say much of anything about that because we don't really have any way to connect with that because we're not of that. We're of this universe as far as we know, as far as we can measure.
Sure.
So the counter model to that, which it's kind of something that I'm proposing here, is the manifest God model. And the manifest God model would suggest that perhaps everything we know, all that we can measure and see, is part of an evolving system. And this evolving system, relative to us, in fact, you could consider as divine, since we are part of it. It created us, essentially. More specifically, you go down to the planet, but we can go right back up to the stars when you consider that you and I, all of our building blocks were stardust at one time. We were built by atom machines and basically by stars and nebula and all these things that are, you know, all around the different galaxies. So a manifest God model is a little bit more what I'm arguing, but then a further question comes, if we are part of it, then can we interact with it? Is there any intelligence there? Is there any consciousness there? And that's really where a lot of the questions lie.
Okay, but when you talk, and stop me if I'm wrong here, I'm looking at words now. A manifest God model. Uh-huh. Manifest means it comes into existence. You can touch it, you can feel it, you can define it, and that's the manifested. Most of what we call spirituality would be the unmanifest, but then here's one of those reversible cause and effect things. It's an unmanifest, but yet everything mm-hmm. in and of itself is spirituality, so it's manifested within you, within me, the desk I'm sitting at, the microphone. It is all part of the same thing. It just takes on different shapes.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, I was going to say, am I close to what you're saying?
Yeah. Except the other part of manifest that we'd have to keep in mind is that part of what oftentimes, and I define spirituality differently.
Whoops, Chad, somehow we lost you. Okay, we're trying to get Chad back. We're talking about spirituality, and we're talking about maybe the manifesting of spirituality, the ability to see it, and maybe that there is a difference between the definition of what we have of spirituality combined with religion over the years. Maybe based on our cultures, maybe it's taking a step up to a different definition, a definition that you and I have to take a look at and realistically be able to put our arms around to be able to function with a normal everyday life. We're being told so many things by so many people with different agendas that it gets very confusing. And I think what we've lost is the ability to the essence of what God really is, the essence of spirituality, the essence of whatever that thing is inside of you that connects with what's outside and goes way beyond the planet. And I think we might have got Chad back. Will we have you? No. Okay. So, Chad, are you there? All right. So, when we're talking about provable, you know, provable is very interesting. Science has to prove something. But what about the provable existence of a spirituality of what you feel, how your life runs, when that miracle, whatever that is, happens to you, when you get that moment of recognition of something that you haven't had before, and you're able to move through your life in such a different dimension, and is that not touching, and is that not the existence of God in some phase or form? And religion in and of itself, there are so many different religions, but at base, if you really look at the base, all of it, there is that essence, that supreme essence that is the guiding force of all of it. You know, there's something called an agnostic. An agnostic is somebody who believes... Oh, good, I got you back.
Hello again.
Okay, we're
not
back.
Not sure what
okay.
happened there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I forgot to tell you, when you do these shows, you got to put the tinfoil on so the space rays don't get us. Or they're after us from the
water.
Well,
I gotta watch out for that, yeah.
Okay, but so in essence, what we're really dealing with when we talk about spirituality, We're talking about that certain something that you might not be able to put down in writing and exactly define it, but something that you experience within. And that certain something should be the overarching theme of all the different religions. I was just talking when you were gone there for a while. And realistically, when you come down to it, if we can ever get together externally of what goes on internally, because if you look at the different religions, you look at Catholicism, Christianity, Judaism, you look at all the different religions, when it comes right down to it, the belief underneath is the same in a supreme deity. Now, once you get beyond that, there's the difference between if they're an infant, they'll kill them and so on and so forth, and if you don't believe my way, you're going to hell and all of that. Those are control mechanisms, which have nothing to do with God and spirituality.
Right, and that's exactly why I make a distinction between a definition of spirituality separate from religion, because religion is really steeped in traditions. Wrong or right, a lot of traditions have, you know, their faults and their good points. You know, the fact that you can get a group of people together and try to do good deeds is a good point. But the fact that people may get together under the banner of a certain religion and want to fight another religion just because they want to be right, that's not a good thing. So it's important to get away from those arguments, because then you get in a quagmire of bragging rights, really. Of
absolutely.
Yeah. So that was why I realized early on, and it just kind of manifested in the book, that I needed to get away from that and get the reader to a point hopefully that they could get away from that way of thinking as well. Because most of us, you know, when you consider where the topic and ideas of spirituality come from, they come from when we're really young. You know, it's really imposed upon us when we're very young. And before we really have any opinion or know any better or have any ability to argue a point. I mean, most of us have a lot of our traditions and religions set up almost by the age of 5 or 6. You know, how is a 5-year-old going to argue against a priest, for example, on, you know, whether he's right or wrong about the universe? He doesn't have the capacity to do that. So that's a big barrier to get over first before you can have an intelligent conversation about spirituality and science that may or may not explain.
I think, Chad, one of the biggest problems that we face today when it comes to religion, there are many, many good people who have a belief system that it's a religious belief system, and they live their life a good life, and they live their life for other people. But then what I think kills it is, I think, was it 6, 7, 8 months ago? It was a Sunday. I was flashing through the channels, and I hit this one religious program, and the guy was, I mean, he was rolling. He was on it. You know, you send your $1,000 in, and you get your miracle, and so on and so forth.
For a price.
But the key, what got me riveted to this, behind him, I swear to you, behind him was a sign that said, miracles are not guaranteed.
Hey, at least he had the clause on the program. Most of them don't even have that little clause, you know, at least some kind of truth in advertising, I suppose.
Yeah, and it has copy, you know, send your $1,000 in and we'll get you a miracle. We're not going to guarantee the miracle. And then when you really take a look at that, that is not what religion was supposed to be or stand for.
Not at all. And ironically, if you go back to the base of where a lot of these religions come from, you know, a lot of the folks who they're modeled after, whether you're talking about Muhammad or Jesus Christ or even the Buddha philosophy, which is a little more philosophy and a little less religion in some aspects, those folks had no intention for religious entities to rise up in their name. That wasn't really their goal. And, you know, they just kind of take on a life of their own. For good or bad, if we look at religious entities, and I kind of bring this up in the book, there's a whole study of something called complexity or complexity science. And what it really does is it breaks down systems into almost behaviors and patterns. So, for example, we can break down our human body as a system. And that system interacts at a whole bunch of different levels. It interacts at a chemical level. It interacts at a social level, which is where, you know, minds are interacting and people interacting. And it also has internal environments and external environments that it's constantly interacting with, temperature, pressure, all these kinds of things. Well, yeah. It turns out that from a complex adaptive system point of view, you can look at any system, and that includes religious institutions. It also includes corporations. It also includes cities, states, countries, and treat them as an organism. And in that sense, an organism, as we have studied most organisms, organisms want to survive and thrive. And so in some sense, you can't fault the institution for wanting to survive and thrive, because that's what it's there for. I've never seen a religion that or a company that says, okay, we're going to start and then immediately shut down. That's not their goal. You know, so they usually want to survive and thrive, and some do and some don't.
Chad, I hate to do this to you, but we're starting to run out of time, and
okay.
I could talk to you about this probably all night. Let me ask you, do you have a website that we can find you at, get the book,
Absolutely.
And get more information?
Yes, I have a website. It's Dr. Chad Kennedy, drchadkennedy.com, and I've got a blog that's going on there, and also you can reach my book there. I've got several links to several different sites if you want to purchase the book from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Author House. Even iBook, apparently, is what I found out.
Great. Okay, Chad, hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I've appreciated your time.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And the evening were new again. I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Dusty